Hear now the argument in the case of United States against High. Mr. Hoberville.
Good morning. You recognize me for all three of you. My name is Alan Hoppermel. I represent Mr. High in this appeal. I'd like to start the argument with the sentencing issues because that's the one issue where there's been some significant change in the law since the briefs were filed. Again, Mr. High was sentenced as an armed career criminal. He needed three predicate violent felonies to qualify. The trial court found he had four. I concede that the drug offense qualifies. That's one. You have my argument in the briefs about the battery, but that argument's definitely trudging uphill in the face of the Supreme Court, and I don't have more to say about that. I think the two relevant cases where there has been change in Mr. High's favor would be in the case of the conviction for failing to report to jail and for reckless endangering safety. And to take them up in that order, on the conviction for failing to report to jail, Mr. High was convicted under WSSTAT Section 946.425. This statute applies to a person who's been sentenced to the local jail, received a stay of that sentence, and then does not appear on the day he's supposed to. In the very recent case of United States v. Templeton at 543 F3rd 378, this court held in passing on the question of whether escapes qualify or not, specifically that a walkaway is not a crime of violence under Begay, and here I quote again, nor is a simple failure to report to custody, which violates WSSTAT Section 946.425. That's at page 383 of that decision. For the reasons I've stated in my arguments in the brief and given the Templeton statement, which I believe is as clear as a statement can be on this point, it is my position that, in fact, this court has overruled its prior precedent in this area, and at least with regard to the specific offense at issue here, which is not escape, but failing to report to start a sentence, this court has already held that, in fact, that cannot qualify as a predicate offense. Unless there are further questions on that, that's pretty much the sum of my argument on that point.
And you don't think we need to wait for Chambers to be decided?
At this point, I don't, all right? I guess I'll agree with it. I didn't in the first place, but I can see the pragmatic value of waiting for something like that. But the fact is, I believe the analysis in Templeton is spot on, and it addresses the issue. And I think, again, given that we're talking not about escape of any form, but simply this other offense of failing to report, that can be dealt with, at least in the context of our case, on its merits without waiting for the response to Chambers, in part because, well, if Chambers says escapes just can't be crimes of violence, then that would include me. But even if it said an escape of some form might be a crime of violence, it still wouldn't address the issue that we're dealing with here because, again, I don't think failure reports the same.
Tell what the Supreme Court will say in Chambers. The only people who know are the justices. It was argued 2 months ago, may come down any time.
Right. As of yesterday, I checked, and it didn't seem to have, so here we are.
Well, the court hasn't sat for the last month. Right.
Again, who knows?
Very likely to hand down decisions on Sundays.
Indeed. As it turns out, again, other than wait for them, I think...
We've got the recklessness.
Right. Let's deal with that, then, because that's where things have actually gotten interesting. The government, of course, cites the court to United States versus Smith, and that's the relevant site. The government, however, I think misconstrues the decision in Smith and in particular Wisconsin law.
We have Smith and Jimenez, and we'll figure out what they mean. I'm interested in what Wisconsin statute 939.241 means. Now, here's the problem I have. Smith and Jimenez against Mukasey hold that recklessness is not enough. The question is whether 939.241 is a recklessness offense. It's got that word in it, surely. But take the crime of firing a gun deliberately into a crowd, not caring whether you hit someone. Now, that crime has both an intent component, that is, intentionally firing the gun, and a recklessness component, that is, not caring whether you hit somebody. And I assume that kind of statute is outside Smith. Deliberately firing a gun, being recklessly indifferent to what happens, is probably a crime of violence. The question I'm worried about is, how does one classify Wisconsin statute 939.241? Is it deliberately doing something with reckless indifference to the consequence, or is it recklessly doing something? That's the question I have.
Right. Well, The short answer would be it's recklessly doing something, but that's just the start. Wisconsin did something that Indiana didn't. Indiana managed to conflate all three concepts of knowing, intentionality, knowing, and simple recklessness.
I'm asking what right. kind of critter this statute is.
Well, Wisconsin hasn't made things quite that ambiguous. Wisconsin has a separate statute about criminal intent, 939.23. And in that statute, it states that criminal intent is an element to the crime, and it uses either the word intent to or some form of the words know or believe. So knowledge includes, requires rather, that the actor believes that the specified act exists. Requires a very, you know, specific knowledge. And intent means that he has the purpose to do the thing or cause the result specified, or is aware that his or her conduct is practically certain to cause that result. And criminal, and by the way, it says that as far as intent, then the actor must have knowledge of the facts which are necessary to make his or her conduct criminal. That is to say, that's what we would call in law school, I guess, specific intent, as opposed to general intent, which would be the knowledge. Wisconsin has a separate statute for recklessness, which is 939.24. And I think the fact that Wisconsin has made that very distinct and clear distinction between intentionality or knowing conduct on one hand and reckless conduct on the other, and has two separate words to describe it. And 939.24 sub 2 specifically says that if criminal recklessness is an element, you'll see that indicated by the term reckless or recklessly. And that, of course, is the crime of second-degree recklessly endangering safety, which is the offense of which Mr. High was convicted.
Yeah. Let me ask my question a different way. Have the state courts in Wisconsin considered the sort of question I asked, that is, does 939.241 require some intentional behavior, reckless with regard to consequence, or will the state courts allow a conviction if everything is reckless? Since I did a sports example in the last case, let me do another one. Plaxico Burress, the receiver for the New York Giants, recently shot himself in the thigh because he was careless with respect to his own gun, and he didn't know he was pulling the trigger. I assume that's reckless from beginning to end, because you don't intentionally shoot yourself in the thigh. Suppose what Plaxico Burress did was prosecuted under 939.241. Would he be guilty or innocent as Wisconsin courts construe that statute?
We're assuming the bullet hit someone other than him, right? Because he can't be prosecuted for shooting himself. Actually, I'm going to say none of the above, and here's why. Wisconsin has a third level of mental state, and I think it addresses the exact scenario you just posed. 939.25 is called criminal negligence. There is a form of negligence in Wisconsin which is criminal, and criminal negligence means ordinary negligence to a high degree. Conduct that the actor should realize creates a substantial and reasonable risk of death or great bodily harm to another.
I'm now getting totally lost. You know, Leonard Hand once wrote an opinion saying that there were all these different levels of intent, and he couldn't for the life of him figure out what they meant. And now you're beginning to drive me into Hand's corner.
Well, there is always hard to find the borders on these levels.
Have the state courts, you know, I know what the language of 939.24 is. I find it hard to get around, hard to grasp, that is. Have the state courts tackled this question? Have the state courts said whether, in my Plaxico Burress example, he would be guilty under 0.24 as opposed to 0.25 or 0.23?
I don't have a direct answer. I'm sorry. I don't have a case I can give back to you on that.
Are we permitted to treat this as a case in which the crime was firing two shots at a moving car?
No. That is to say, and I don't mean to make that sound so rude, but the fact is it's a simple question with a direct answer. All of this court's decisions, and Begay itself, and you have to only read Smith and Templeton to see this, specifically state that the specific manner in which the offense was committed is irrelevant.
What did the indictment say?
The information simply charges the offense. In Wisconsin, you don't have speaking informations.
Yes. That's the problem. We actually have that in the record, and the information just charges the language of the statute. It has no facts in it at all.
Right. If by in the record you refer to the copy of the information that the prosecutor sent in request to the court, I do want to simply point out that she unfortunately sent you the original information which charged first-degree reckless endangerment, although I doubt that it affects this analysis. The fact is that was subsequently amended to the second degree, but I just didn't want confusion from that. Yes,
but in any event, at least the thing that we have looked at does not state any facts. It
that
just
is correct.
Charges the language of the statute.
That is correct.
And that the amended information doesn't do any different, you say.
That is correct.
All right.
Simply
and was he tried or did he plead guilty?
I believe he pled guilty, but I do have an answer for you if you bear with me for just a second. Yes, he pled.
Well, can't we look at the guilty plea when the statute covers a range of activities, and the indictment or the information doesn't particularize it? Aren't we permitted to look at a guilty plea?
Well, that says he admits that he committed the crime. I honestly don't see how that changes the nature of the crime.
Yeah.
He admitted to doing it.
Do we have the guilty plea colloquy in the record?
No, not to my knowledge. This whole issue didn't come up at sentencing. Unfortunately, it predates Begay.
Well, but look, it certainly doesn't predate the earlier cases like Shepard that talk about looking at both the charging papers and the guilty plea colloquy, if it's a guilty plea. Maybe we need to send it back if there's something that might be relevant there.
Well, again,
The prosecutor says there was an intentional firing of two shots at a car. Do you know where that came from? It obviously didn't come from the information. Did it come from the guilty plea colloquy? Where else?
I don't know. I did not represent him at the earlier offense. I have no knowledge of that, to tell you the direct answer.
Okay.
I do not believe it is relevant to determine the legal issue of whether second-degree recklessness is or is not a crime of violence, to look at how any one particular person may or may not have violated. I can, to be honest, think of an almost infinite number of ways you could violate that, and I think that's why you don't make that inquiry.
The Wisconsin courts have not defined recklessness?
The statute defines recklessness. If you're asking me for something beyond that, typically all you get is case by case, this is or this isn't. The statute has a fairly... It defines it probably as closely as you can.
The statute doesn't say anything at all.
Well...
Surely the courts... I mean, there are close cases involving recklessness. Don't the courts say this is reckless or this is not reckless? Who must say that? Have you looked?
No. The issue has not come up. The truth is
the issue has not come up. It's
well, then, perhaps we should do a supplemental brief on it.
As Judge Easterbrook said, there are forms of reckless... You can be found guilty of first-degree murder for recklessness, even if you're not shooting. Suppose you shoot into the lighted windows of a train. You're not aiming at anybody, but if you hit somebody, you could be prosecuted for first-degree murder. That's the extreme recklessness, because you know that you're creating a very high risk of bodily injury. That's all that's required. Now, don't the Wisconsin courts talk about that sort of thing and apply it to this statute?
That ends up being a factual issue that juries end up resolving. It would be my response to that.
That's a question. Don't the Wisconsin courts talk? They must have close questions involving recklessness. Don't they? When they discuss, they say, this is reckless, this isn't reckless.
It's usually whether it's reckless or intentional as opposed to otherwise. That tends to come up in a sufficiency of the evidence review.
No,
you get not much help out of that.
Is it reckless or is it negligent, right?
Well, unfortunately, criminal negligence is also a crime in Wisconsin.
Yes, I know, but it's a different crime. You can't be convicted of reckless endangerment if you just were negligent. So I would think there would be cases in which discuss, is this negligent or is this reckless?
Okay. Negligent and reckless is not, in my opinion, the correct breakpoint. It's reckless or intentional. That's the Supreme Court's breakpoint.
You don't understand. Look, I tell you, there are forms of recklessness which are treated as the exact equivalent of deliberately murdering someone. Did you know that?
Actually, I don't believe that's the state of the law in Wisconsin.
Oh, of course, it's the state of the law everywhere.
Well, I do not have a direct answer to the question in the sense of having a case that somehow elucidates that particular point. I would like to draw...
Suppose for fun, you put a blindfold on and then drive at a high speed in a city. You don't think that's a violent felony?
Not for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act. I think that's no different than drunk driving.
Ridiculous.
That's the same as drunk driving, in my opinion, because drunk driving basically gives you beer goggles.
I'm not talking about drunk driving. I gave you a very precise example.
Right. I think that's recklessness. You're not intending to hurt anyone in particular, any more than drunks intend to hurt people.
That's not how the law treats conduct of that sort.
It's certainly not intentional. I don't think they could possibly prosecute that. But I would like to draw us back to the Supreme Court.
That's actually the problem. Examples like shooting through a lighted window of a train are intentional.
Right.
Intentional with respect to the activity and reckless with respect to the consequence.
And the Supreme Court has spoken to that exact point as cited in Smith itself. Because one of the examples the Supreme Court stated specifically did not quote.
Judge Posner and I are not asking about what the Supreme Court said in Begay. We're asking what the Wisconsin courts have said about the meaning of recklessness in their own law.
But I was going to address...
You can't help us on that.
You asked the question about whether the intentional act and the reckless state of mind constitute a crime of violence, and the Supreme Court says no. They use the example of the reckless tampering with a product, which requires actually knowingly tampering with the product, which I regard as equivalent to your example of shooting the gun. And that you do that knowing act with reckless disregard for the risk.
Thank you, Mr. Hoberman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Rita Rumbelow for the United States. Regrettably, I also do not have any Wisconsin case law that would distinguish reckless conduct from negligent conduct, but as Mr. Habermill said,
the guilty plea, is that in the guilty plea colloquy in the record?
No, and this is why. Because under existing case law at the time of sentencing, they did not challenge this conviction. Recklessly endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon under law at the time seemed clearly a violent felony for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act. Because it was not challenged, the government did not go back and seek a 1997 plea colloquy. Had they challenged it, yes, my allegation.
Well, challenging it in this court, could have gone back and found the plea colloquy for purposes of the appeal.
Please don't touch the microphone.
I'm sorry. Yes, I could have, but no, I did not, because this is under plain error.
It's actually a public record. All one has to do is go look it up.
Transcripts are not
open. Transcribed, that may be the problem.
That usually is the problem, Your Honor, is that we have to go back and find the court reporter, and sometimes it takes some time. But if this court were to remand, we would definitely supplement the record and obtain a copy of that plea colloquy. But that is why it was not introduced at sentencing, and that is why the facts and...
Now, given what Mr. Habermill said about the difference between 0.23 and 0.24... you have any idea why High was prosecuted under 0.24 rather than 0.23? Because if he deliberately fired two shots at a passing car, it sounds like he's committed the offense defined in subsection 2.3.
You would think. But because 2.4 requires that an actor be aware of the risk they are creating, I can only think that that is why the local prosecutor prosecuted him under 2.4. Mr. Habermill tries to make a big distinction between 2.3 and 2.4, but I really don't think there is one. 2.4 requires...
Is your belief based on something Wisconsin courts have said, or is it just a priori?
Well, you know, one example, Your Honor... The jury instruction here in the Seventh Circuit, when we...
You're not answering my question. Is it based on something the Wisconsin courts have said?
No.
Or is it a priori? All right.
Does 2.4 carry a lighter sentence?
I have no idea.
Because, you know, there are different risks of bodily injury that conduct creates, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So a lesser risk might be so small that we wouldn't call it a violent felony, right? So it'd be nice to know what the risk range contemplated by the statute is.
Well, 241 means the actor creates an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm to another human being.
Yes.
So it doesn't sound like slight risk. It sounds like big risk.
It is a substantial risk. And again, it requires that the actor be aware
of the risk,
which to me indicates purposeful conduct and knowing conduct. Again, if I may, when we instruct juries in the Seventh Circuit in the Western District of Wisconsin, and under our definition of knowingly, we instruct juries when the word knowingly is used in these instructions, it means that the defendant realized what he or she was doing and was aware of the nature of his or her conduct. So because Wisconsin's statutory language equates to knowingly, that is why the prosecutors charge under this statute.
And so is the jury instruction the same in Wisconsin, the definition of knowingly?
Yes, the jury instruction in Wisconsin states, the second element requires that the defendant endangered the safety of another by criminally reckless conduct. This requires that the defendant's conduct created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm to another person, and that the defendant was aware that his conduct created such a risk. That's the second element of the jury instruction in Wisconsin.
Would that include drunk driving?
Drunk driving is charged under a completely separate statute in Wisconsin.
And actually, 939.243 says that being drunk is not a defense to a charge of recklessness. So presumably, you could be so drunk that you didn't have much awareness, but still be convicted under this statute.
If that's what the jury found, but arguably they'd say you weren't aware.
Look, but that's what the statute says. The statute says that you can be guilty of criminal recklessness even though you are so befuddled that you really don't know what's going on as a result of drink, which undermines your argument that this must really be an intent statute of some kind. Now, maybe it's just internally inconsistent that subsection 1 calls for actual awareness, and subsection 3 says if you don't have actual awareness, but that's because of drink, you're still guilty.
And maybe the Wisconsin State Legislature is looking to amend that statute now after the Supreme Court's decision in Begay. I do not know, but when you look at in order for John High to be convicted of second-degree recklessly endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon, and we know from the charging document it was a gun, we know that he had to have been aware of the substantial risk that he was creating. And, yes, I can go back and order a copy of the plea colloquy if this court remands and so desires that I supplement the record. But just on its face, I think when we look at the Smith case, Smith held that only those crimes with a mens rea of recklessness won't count as violent felonies for purposes of the Armed Career Criminal Act. And it's the government's position that Wisconsin's statute 939.241 does not have a mens rea of only recklessness. It's knowing. So under this particular statute, for this particular defendant, he knew what he was doing, and with or without the plea colloquy, I think that this court can find that it is a violent felony. But if categorically this court declines that invitation, then we would, I think, welcome the opportunity to provide a transcript of the plea colloquy like we do in escapes, you know, now after Templeton, trying to determine.
What if he just fired a gun in the air?
Outside a nightclub in Indianapolis, a case we had shortly before Begay.
And, you know, I've had defendants who've been convicted of that in the past, and it was used as a violent felony. But, again, this was prior to Begay. Yes, because it creates a substantial risk. You're outside a nightclub. I mean, I think if you said, what if he fired a gun on a farm field or hit himself accidentally? No, that would be negligence, like Mr. Habermill said. But if you are in any area that's, you know, where people are present, you create a substantial risk. You know, you may not be aware that somebody's...
Not really. If you fire a gun, and the chance that the bullet will actually land on someone is very slight.
Could hit property. You know, arson is a...
What, hit a leaf? Penetrate a leaf?
You know...
Kill a hummingbird on the way down.
Then I guess what would happen then is that we don't take a categorical approach in these cases, and that the government is able to, you know, look to the charging document and the plea colloquy in each case. And I do think Smith may have been perhaps a little bit too overbroad, and that each statute should be addressed individually. You know, Indiana's differs from Wisconsin. You know, right now we're grappling with, well, what does Wisconsin's really mean? Wisconsin surely will differ from Illinois. And so I think that each statute has to be analyzed separately. But, and again, I, you know, would welcome the chance to do some supplemental briefing on the Wisconsin case law on reckless conduct versus negligent conduct. As for Mr. High's failure to report, I'm well aware of this court's opinion in Templeton. I understand that this court did not hold Templeton in abeyance pending Chambers. I recognize that, and that's really all I can say on that point. I do think that Mr. High's...
Actually, a little more attractive to hold this case pending Chambers, because Templeton came up well before Chambers was argued. But now Chambers has been under advisement for 2 months. It's conceivable. Court comes back next week. It's conceivable they'll resolve it next week.
Yes.
Not that we could get this case out by next week, but...
Oh, I still ask that this court hold this opinion in abeyance pending Chambers, but I recognize that it wasn't willing to do so in the Templeton case. As for Mr. High's misdemeanor conviction for battery as a repeater, it was punishable by a term exceeding 1 year and squarely fits within the definition of violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Does the court have any questions on the probable cause, exigent circumstances argument, or sufficiency of the evidence?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.